It might seem absolutely astonishing after the miracles that have been listed in chapters 14 and 15 that the Pharisees and Sadducees coming together here, they didn't like each other, but they're coming together against Jesus because they have a common enemy, and they're asking for a sign. Now, the Pharisees had already asked for a sign, and they had been dismissed. Now, Pharisees and Sadducees are asking for a sign. You can see that Matthew is building up the tension also, isn't he, you see, gradually, so that things are going to come to a head by the end of the book. He answered, verse 2, and said to them, "When it is evening, you say, it will be fair weather, for the sky is red. And in the morning it will be foul weather today, for the sky is red and threatening. Hypocrites, you know how to discern the face of the sky, but you cannot discern the signs of the times." Now, whether we put the word hypocrites in there, which is in the majority text or not, the sense doesn't change, and certainly there were hypocrites. But what Jesus is saying is, you know, by using your common sense, how to discern what's going to happen as far as the weather patterns are concerned. But you, who claim to have all this discernment in the spiritual realm, cannot understand what's going on in front of your face. This is always typical of religious people. They have a false idea of spirituality, and true spirituality is always against false spirituality. And therefore, unless they convert over to the true, they will always be opposed to the true. Verse 4, "A wicked and adulterous generation seeks after a sign." He'd already said that to them. "And no sign shall be given to it except the sign of the prophet Jonah. And he left them and departed." He'd already said that in chapter 12. "Now when his disciples had come to the other side, they had forgotten to take bread. Then Jesus said to them, 'Take heed and beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the Sadducees.'" We haven't really met the Sadducees before, but now we see that they are in cahoots with the Pharisees, at least as against the person of Jesus. "And they reasoned among themselves, saying, 'It is because we have taken no bread.'" Now, this seems to be a very strange way of reasoning. Now, why are they reasoning this way? Well, the only answer can be is that that's what they're thinking about. They are thinking not about what Jesus is saying in relation to the scribes and the Pharisees and their opposition to him, but they're concerned about the fact that they haven't got anything to eat. And so that's uppermost in their mind, and they think, naturally, that that's uppermost in Jesus' mind too. "But Jesus, being aware of it, said to them, 'O ye of little faith.'" Again, why is their lack of faith being rebuked? It's being rebuked because faith should drive understanding. Faith should drive reasoning. Verse 7, you see. "Why do you reason among yourselves because you have brought no bread? Do you not yet understand?" You see, again, this issue of faith and understanding. "Or remember the 5 loaves of the 5,000 and how many baskets you took up, nor the 7 loaves of the 4,000 and how many large baskets you took up? How is it that you do not understand that I did not speak to you concerning bread, but to beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees?" Then they understood what he meant. Verse 12. Jesus didn't explain what he meant by the leaven of the Pharisees and Sadducees. It should have been quite clear. But he corrected their misconception and then restated his warning that he had said in verse 6. And so, verse 12, "Then they understood that he did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread, but of the doctrine of the Pharisees and Sadducees." So again, you can see that leaven has a negative connotation. It even has a negative connotation to the disciples' first instinct about bread. Notice verse 12. "He did not tell them to beware of the leaven of bread." So leaven here still has a negative connotation to them. Do you see that? Verse 13. "When Jesus came into the region of Caesarea Philippi, he asked his disciples, saying, 'Who do men say that I, the Son of Man, am?' So they said, 'Some say John the Baptist, Herod thought that, for example. Some Elijah, and others Jeremiah, or one of the prophets. Now, that's not bad company, is it? These are exalted figures indeed. He said to them, "But who do you say that I am?" You see, there are many people who were looking at Jesus and they were misidentifying him. Yes, some said he was the son of David, but some just identified him as being one of the prophets come back to life. Simon Peter answered and said, "You are the Christ, the Son of the living God." So the Christ, you see, is equated in Peter's mind with the Son of God. I hope that you see that. Now, whether that was so because of what Peter had learned of Jesus, which is probably true, or whether that is how Jews of that time interpreted the term Messiah, is hard to say. Probably the former. But Jesus answered and said to him, "Blessed are you, Simon Bar-Jonah, son of Jonah, for flesh and blood has not revealed this to you, but my Father who is in heaven." Now, this revealing has got to do with the understanding and the certainty expressed in Simon's profession of faith in verse 16. It is not just that Peter is just having a go and guessing. Peter's absolutely certain of his identification. And that certainty and that understanding comes as a revelation of God. Now that's important as we understand what happens next. Verse 18. "And I also say to you that you are Peter, and on this rock I will build my church, and the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it." Now, this is where the Roman Catholics have Peter being the rock, and the church, which they interpret as being the Roman Catholic Church, is built upon the rock, who is Peter, who they say is the first pope. And that's where they get their basic ecclesiology from. This is not what Jesus is saying. Peter is the name given by Jesus to Simon, of course. And Peter in Aramaic does mean rock, as any Roman Catholic will tell you. Although in Greek, Petros means stone, as opposed to Petra, that means rock, like an outcropping of rock or so on. So what is Jesus saying? There seems to be a play on words here, but what is the rock in verse 18? Is it Peter? Well, no. Jesus doesn't say, "You are Peter, and upon you I will build my church," which is what would have been expected if Peter was in Jesus' mind. It is, "You are Peter, and on this rock." Now, what is this rock? This rock is that which has been revealed to Peter by the Father, verse 17. And what was it that was revealed? The true identity of Christ, the Son of the living God. So, the rock is either the profession of verse 16, or, probably more likely, I think, the fact that the profession was revealed by the Father. That's the rock. Because anyone could have the profession, but not the real understanding and faith that is required of the profession. But if it's revealed by the Father in heaven, then that really is a rock. And it's that revelation, that understanding given from heaven, that is the basis for the church. And the gates of Hades shall not prevail against it. So that is how I think this passage is to be understood. "And I will give you," Peter is the one who spoke, and so Peter is the one now being addressed. "I will give you the keys of the kingdom of heaven, and whatever you bind on earth will be bound in heaven, and whatever you loose on earth will be loosed in heaven." This is a prediction of the future ministry of Peter after the resurrection. Now these keys are also given to the other disciples by Jesus later on. So they're not given to Peter alone. But this does, I think, show that Peter is going to be used in a special way by Jesus after the Passion. Now what is this binding and loosing? Well, this is not something that we can do. This is something that has been given to Peter and the disciples, the apostles. This is a special authority that has been given to them and is not repeated for us. So whatever it is, and it says some kind of spiritual authority, it is something that pertains to their future office. Then he commanded his disciples that they should tell no one that he was Jesus the Christ. Now that seems to be a strange thing. Hadn't John the Baptist come preaching this kind of message? Well, he'd certainly come preaching that Jesus was the Lamb of God and was the one who the prophet Isaiah had prophesied. And Jesus had announced that he was the Son of Man, and the disciples certainly understood that he claimed to be Christ. But this was not to be their preaching. And this is probably because the hour of Christ's passion had not yet come, and Jesus did not want to attract undue attention. He did not seek the publicity of people going around pointing their fingers at him and saying, "This is the one you should follow." That was okay for John the Baptist at the beginning of his ministry, but that was a particular and special role that John enjoyed. It was not given to anybody else. Verse 21. From that time, Jesus began to show his disciples that he must go to Jerusalem and suffer many things from the elders and the chief priests and scribes and be killed and be raised the third day. Now that coincides with the sign of the prophet Jonah that he'd already spoken to the scribes and Pharisees about. But look at Peter's reaction. This shows that Peter is rather superficial in his reasoning. Not that the revelation was superficial, that came from God, but Peter's use and understanding of it was superficial. Verse 22, then Peter took him aside. Peter's getting a bit big for his boots here, and began to rebuke him, saying, "Far be it from you, Lord, this shall not happen to you." Then he turned and said to Peter, "Get behind me, Satan. You are an offence to me, for you are not mindful of the things of God, but the things of men." Jesus is saying here, you're not in the right mind. You're not spiritually minded. You're not understanding. You're not thinking along the right lines here, Peter. He gets a sharp rebuke. He'd become exalted, I think, from Jesus' words in verse 18 and 19, and so he gets a sharp rebuke in verse 23 to bring him down to size. This also shows that Satan is involved even at this time. Although he's been dismissed by Jesus in Matthew 4, he's still working, he's still behind the scenes, he's still following Jesus around, and he's influencing both Jesus' enemies and his followers. And of course we find out that Satan will enter Judas Iscariot in a few chapters' time. Then Jesus said to his disciples, "If anyone desires to come after me, let him deny himself and take up his cross and follow me." Now Jesus had already spoken of this in chapter 10, verse 38. But now he repeats it, as no doubt he often did with his teaching. And this time I think it hit home a bit harder. Verse 25. "For whoever desires to save his life will lose it, but whoever loses his life for my sake will find it." Jesus must come first. For what profit is it to a man if he gains the whole world and loses his own soul? Most people, if you gave them the choice, would probably prefer to gain the whole world and lose their soul, because they're not thinking. They're thinking about the here and now, and not the life hereafter. But true followers of Jesus have got an eternal perspective. They've got a spiritual perspective. And they understand that this world is perishing, and that our souls will either go to eternal bliss or to eternal punishment. And so Jesus continues, "Or what will a man give in exchange for his soul?" You see, a person can have everything his heart desires, but he'd better give it all up if his soul is threatened by it. "For the Son of Man will come." Here's the note of judgment once more. "In the glory of his Father with his angels, and then he will reward each according to his works. The rewards come at the second coming. Assuredly, I say to you, there are some standing here who shall not taste death till they see the Son of Man coming in his kingdom. Now that is a very cryptic thing for Jesus to say. What does he mean? Well, this is explained in the next chapter, the chapter on the Transfiguration.